Sunstone presents Melchizedek, Literary, Political Commodity, recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
I think we'll begin the session now. Maybe a few more people will drift in. The paper that you're here to listen to is by L.R. Jacobs, who couldn't be here because he is at Cornell University right now pursuing his degree in Christian Origins and Gnosticism. And the person who will be reading his paper is Scott Dunn. Some of you may know Mr. L.R. Jacobs. He's a pretty colorful person, so I'll just read you some of the stuff from his bio. He has two bachelor degrees, one in French literature and one in philosophy, and a master in theological studies from Harvard. He has worked as a taxidermist, tailor, pianist, artist, and probably more specifically to the topic, he's been a research consultant at the LDS Genealogical Library in Salt Lake City. He's currently working on a forthcoming book that's going to be on salvation in early Christianity and an article on the Nag Hammadi text. He's fluent in French, German, Latin, Greek, and Coptic, and he served a mission in Quebec, Canada. Some of you may know Scott Dunn, too. Scott's kind of familiar because he was the former managing editor of Sunstone Magazine. He's now editor of Triangle Magazine and a freelance editor. He's also worked for Seventh East Press. He has a master's in linguistics from BYU and has published articles and written a book on Samoan grammar and served a mission. So I'll now turn over the time to Scott. Oh, wait, before I do, I have a few things I need to tell you. We do not have a respondent for this session, unfortunately. We weren't able to find somebody who was qualified. And also, Scott does not feel that he can answer questions because it was L.R. Jacobs who wrote the paper. So we're not going to have questions and comments afterwards. Okay.
This microphone is only for the tape recorder. It doesn't amplify, and I've been having a little problem with laryngitis. So if my voice starts to flag, you might want to sneak up towards the front of the room. In the last few years, it has become increasingly clear that Mormon students of ancient documents and traditions have pursued an exegetical bias which should be considered unacceptable, both from a rational as well as methodological point of view. I refer to the predilection of some writers for interpreting early texts in light of modern theological or philosophical ideas with little regard for their original historical contexts. An attempt is often made to relate certain texts or traditions to each other, even when the connections are seldom supported by the available evidence. It must be admitted that ancient authors were frequently guilty of similar exegetical errors, and this fact must be clearly understood by any modern scholar who attempts to utilize such materials in his or her exegesis. The purpose of this paper, then, is to discuss the most likely meaning and significance of the early Jewish and Christian traditions concerning the figure of Melchizedek, with a conscious effort to avoid the interpretive fallacies just mentioned. Melchizedek is mentioned twice in the ancient Hebrew Bible, Genesis 14, verses 18 through 20, and Psalms 110, verse 4. Scholars have been able to demonstrate quite clearly that much of the legendary material which was included in the early Hebrew literary compositions had its origin in Canaanite tradition. It is certain that most of the Pentateuchal narrative, or five books of Moses, was constructed in literary as opposed to oral form no earlier than the period of the Davidic monarchy. This would include the Melchizedek tradition in Genesis 14. The majority of scholars who have worked with this passage agree that its content is essentially Canaanite in origin. Ancient Hebrews may have been acquainted with the story in some form or other, but Melchizedek, either as a legendary or actual historical figure, was probably a Canaanite priest king who ruled an area of Canaanite Palestine from a locale the Hebrew scriptures called Shalem or Shalom. Scholars have long recognized that the name Melchizedek was composed of the two ancient Semitic roots, Melech and Sedek. I say Semitic rather than merely Hebrew, since these linguistic elements have also been recognized recently in ancient Semitic, Assyrian, and Canaanite documents unearthed at Assur, Mari, and Ugarit. In the literature of these sites, Melech has been identified as the name of a deity, as well as the word for king. According to Frank Cross, Sedek is extremely common in Amorite, Ugaritic, Canaanite, and Hebrew names. Alone, Sedek usually appears as the personification of the concept justice and as the divine name of certain deities. In this respect, many authors, including Cross, point out the appearance in ancient writings of Sanchuniathon, quoted in the fragment of Philo of Biblos, found in Eusebius' Preparatio Evangelica, of the Canaanite gods Tsuduk and Mishoru, which appear to relate to the biblical concepts of Sedek, or justice, and Mishor, right, found, for example, in Isaiah chapter 11, Psalms chapter 45, chapter 9, chapter 58, and 98. The name Melchizedek, therefore, could have meant, my king is righteous, or my king is the god Sedek. In Genesis 14, however, Melchizedek is referred to as the priest of El Elyon, which has been traditionally, but not quite accurately, translated in English as God the Most High. Since the name El Sedek, meaning El is righteous, appears in the ancient Canaanite literature, the king element in Melchizedek's name may well have been an allusion to the Canaanite deity El. Melchizedek probably therefore means, my king, referring to the god El, is righteous. When the Hebrews entered Canaan for the first time following their exodus from Egypt, Cross points out that patriarchal Canaanite El cults and El shrines dotted the land. It is not known whether the Hebrews adopted the Canaanite god El before or after their entry into Canaan. However, their subsequent identification of Yahweh or Jehovah with the Canaanite god El clearly took place in that region. Melchizedek is referred to in verse 18 as the king of Shalem or Shalom. Originally, this was probably not a reference to an ancient name for Jerusalem. Such a misunderstanding appears to have been the result of several later Jewish references, which eventually identified Shalem with Jerusalem. These include Psalm 73, verse 3, the Genesis Apocryphon 22, verse 13, Targums of Onkelos and Neophiti, and Josephus's Antiquity of the Jews. Several scholars have suggested, and rightly so, that a correct identification of Shalem can be made as a result of a proper understanding of Genesis 33, verse 18. Both J. Gammy and R. H. Smith have demonstrated that the Canaanite town of Shalem could have been either Shechem or a town in the neighborhood of that northern city. According to Gammy, quote, the book of Genesis itself provides us with the proper identification of Shalem. In Genesis 33 and 18 it is written, and Jacob came to Shalem, the city of Shechem. A number of writers chose to read Shalem as an adjective and thus eliminate one of the clearest indications of the correct identity of Shalem. In this case, it's supposed to mean in good condition, in safety, or peace-minded and the like. The use of Shalem in such a manner is, however, without analogy. If the writer intended to convey that Jacob arrived in good condition, the more natural way to have expressed it would have been to use the term adverbially, Be Shalom. The passage, end of quote, the passage as it appears in the Septuagint, or Greek Old Testament, translated from Hebrew well before the time of Christ, states the case clearly. The passage reads, quote, and Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, end quote. It is obvious, however, that by the time the Melchizedek legend was written down by a contemporary of King David, certain Hebrews believed that Shalem was to be identified with Jerusalem. That is apparent from the fact that Genesis 14, verse 17, refers to the King's Valley, which was traditionally located about two stadia from Jerusalem, according to 2 Samuel 18 and 18, and Josephus' Antiquities 8, 10, and 3. That Psalm 73 refers to Shalem as Zion. As is the case with many other ancient Middle Eastern legends and traditions included in the text of the Old Testament, the author who composed the original Hebrew narrative appropriated and interpreted the Canaanite Melchizedek story with a particular purpose in mind. It is no accident that a Canaanite priest king is represented as having had contact with such an illustrious Hebrew figure as Abraham, nor is it surprising that in the same context, an old northern Canaanite town should have been associated with Jerusalem, which was certainly the residence of the narrative's author. Various views have been propounded concerning the purpose of the inclusion of the Melchizedek story. All things considered, the view of G. von Rath, as further developed by Emerton and generally agreed upon by most prominent scholars, including Frank Cross, appears to be the most convincing. Most authors believe that the Melchizedek passage of Genesis 14 and Psalm 110 are related to each other. It seems clear that the passages are rooted in royal ideology and not in priestly ideology. According to von Rath, the Genesis passage, quote, attempts to connect Abraham with the location of the Davidic throne, for Melchizedek, according to the sacred courtly view, was the type, that is, the prototype and precursor of the Davidic or royal dynasty. In the insistence of our narrative that Abraham gave him a tithe, we see Abraham bowing before one who is holding the place or future anointed one. That the most important thing is that Abraham received the blessing of the precursor to David and the Davidic dynasty, that Abraham even had recognized his duty, paying of tithes, etc., toward Jerusalem and its king, end of quote. With little exception, Emerton agrees with von Rath that the essential purpose of the story was to help legitimize the position of Jerusalem as the religious and political capital of Israel, and to acknowledge that the status of David as king had behind it the ancient royal and priestly, albeit Canaanite, status of Melchizedek. It is clear, therefore, that the Melchizedek story provided a precedent or analogy which the obviously sympathetic author employed to legitimize the monarchical claims of his own king, David. After the pattern of the Canaanite and other Middle Eastern monarchical traditions, David proclaimed himself both high priest and king, with Jerusalem as his holy city. Since David's constituents regarded Abraham as a symbol of all Hebrew people, they could point to the Melchizedek legend with assurance and proclaim, "The situation is no different now than it was then. Therefore, as even Abraham, the father of us all, gave his allegiance to both ancient Jerusalem and its priest-king, so should we do likewise with regard to our own priest-king, David, and his holy city." Concerning the basic topology of the Davidic ideology, Cross summarized, quote, "In the transformation of David's kingdom to a full-fledged international power, kingship and royal cultus under the stimulus of Canaanite monarchical institutions evolved further. The Davidic covenant became an unconditional, eternal decree of deity, the Mount of Zion his eternal dwelling place. Cosmic universal rule was attributed to the king in the royal liturgies, as well as eternal election to the dynasty," end of quote. This eternal election to the dynasty is clearly mentioned or alluded to in such biblical passages as Psalms 89, verses 1 to 38, Isaiah chapter 11, Psalms 2, and of course, most importantly, Psalms 110, in which the election of the king is after the order of Melchizedek. That is, David's election to the position of priest-king was after an eternal order and pattern descending from Melchizedek of old. This point must be clearly understood, since there is not one grain of evidence anywhere in Old or New Testament texts which would suggest that any individual except a descendant of the Davidic royal line would ever have been considered an heir to the authority represented by Melchizedek. This would have included the prophets in particular, since their general policy throughout the Old Testament narrative was typically one of opposition to the monarchy and its various symbols of authority. Ancient Hebrew or Christian tradition knew of no Melchizedek priesthood, which would have even remotely resembled the priesthood introduced by Joseph Smith in the 1830s. Language in the LDS temple ceremony, which appears to suggest a concept of royal priesthood, is quite misleading if it is made to reflect an ancient precedent, since only those believed to be literal descendants of David would have been understood anciently to have represented legitimate eternal priests and kings after the order of Melchizedek. The biblical claims concerning Melchizedek authority are quite exclusive. Statements which would insist upon exceptions to this ancient exclusivity, such as those made both by Joseph Smith and Joseph Fielding Smith, seem to have to be rejected as basically inaccurate. Speaking of the ancient Israelites, for example, Joseph Fielding Smith is quite convinced that, quote, "the Lord still left among them a man holding the Melchizedek priesthood with the power to officiate in all its ordinances. Therefore Samuel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Elijah, and others of the prophets held the Melchizedek priesthood," end quote. Even Joseph Smith apparently remarked that, quote, "all priesthood is Melchizedek, but there are different portions or degrees of it. All the prophets had the Melchizedek priesthood and were ordained by God himself," end of quote. These LDS interpretations merely represent the most recent in a long line of misleading attempts to understand the figure of Melchizedek in an exegetical and theological literature extending from the intertestamental period through the Middle Ages. At various times, Melchizedek appears to have been considered a rather fruitful subject for exegetical speculation by both Jewish and Christian authors alike. Surprisingly, some ancient authors appear to have understood the original intention of biblical Melchizedek narrative fairly well. Modern exegetes must remember, however, that all ancient commentary concerning Melchizedek was created with a particular purpose and context in mind, and often represents rather fanciful attempts to elucidate relevant biblical passages by authors who understood virtually nothing concerning the history and construction of the early Jewish textual tradition. The intertestamental period, which is usually considered as extending from about 325 BC to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, witnessed the creation of a fairly substantial collection of Jewish apocalyptic writings, both apocryphal and pseudepigraphic in character. In the last few years, there has been a tremendous expansion of scholarly accomplishments in the area of Jewish and Christian apocalyptic studies, which has provided some clearly demonstrable explanations of the origins and purposes which lie behind the inception of apocalyptic thought in general. Time will not permit a rehearsal of the new trends in the area. The seminal study by Paul Hansen entitled The Dawn of the Apocalyptic, however, is a must for anyone who wishes to understand the essential aspects of this phenomenon. The apocalyptic expectations of the Qumran Covenanters, for example, were quite essential to their tradition and were often clothed in cosmic imagery of uncertain origin. The Qumran Covenanters were disenfranchised sectarians, outcasts from mainstream Judaism. Like most apocalypticists, their eyes were lifted out of this mundane, troublesome world into a mythopoeic realm filled with angels, demons, and of course the glory of their God. It is interesting that the dramatis personae, or heroes, of many of the apocryphal and pseudepigraphic books produced in the intertestamental period, including the literature of the Qumran sectarians, were often rather obscure and somewhat mysterious figures from early Hebrew scriptures. The apocalypticists seemed to be particularly fascinated by such figures as Adam, Enoch, Shem, Melchizedek, et al. So little is mentioned in the biblical narrative concerning these personalities that the urge to fill out their meager biographies with abundant details and colorful imagery must have seemed to the apocalypticist almost impossible to resist. Often the absence of a natural birth or death tradition for figures such as Noah, Enoch, Melchizedek, Elijah, or even Moses provided fruitful field for incredible speculation. The biblical passages which mention the fantastic translations of Enoch, Elijah, and possibly Moses into heaven have suggested to many of those acquainted with the tradition that these folk tales were that these folks were taken to heaven without tasting death to await some eschatological assignment which would eventually bring them forward actively into the cosmos again. The references to Melchizedek were obviously prime material for just this sort of speculation. In this context, we should mention at least two conceptions of the figure of Melchizedek, which are found in the commentaries or midrash produced by members of the Dead Sea community. It must be noted again that any attempt by a modern commentator to suggest that these writings were inspired or constitute a viable elucidation of reality concerning the figure of Melchizedek must be considered to be without scholarly basis. The Qumran conceptions have in fact proven to represent nothing more than fanciful speculation originally intended to augment earlier biblical passages. Melchizedek is mentioned in the Genesis Apocryphon, chapter 22, verses 14 and following, in a section which actually amounts to a translation and repetition of Genesis 14, verses 18 to 20, with a few emendations such as the one already mentioned earlier in this paper, which identifies Melchizedek's Shalem with Jerusalem. Of course, this reference merely perpetuates an error in identification made many years before the Qumran writer composed his commentary. It is in the 2Q Melchizedek document of Qumran Cave 11 that a rather unusual midrashic conception of Melchizedek emerges. Unfortunately, the 2QM document is rather fragmented, and a clear understanding of various words and references in the text is often difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. The first translation of this work by A.S. van der Woude in 1965 has been vastly improved by several scholars, including G. Vermes, from whose translation the following extract represents the most salient portion. Quote, "He," that is God, "will assign them to the sons of heaven and to the inheritance of Melchizedek. For he will cast their lot amid the portions of Melchizedek who returned them there, and will proclaim to them liberty, forgiving them of all their iniquities. And he, that is Melchizedek, will by his strength judge the holy ones of God, executing judgment as it is written concerning him in the songs of David, who said, Elohim has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods he holds judgment. And Melchizedek will avenge the vengeance of the judgments of God, and he will drag them from the hand of Satan. And your Elohim is Melchizedek, who will save them from the hand of Satan. End of quote. It is clear from these passages that at least one Qumran covenanter regarded Melchizedek as an eschatological redeemer or savior. According to the text, Melchizedek will appear at the end and will return the possessions, inheritance of the sons of heaven or the holy ones of God. He will proclaim liberty for them and forgive them of all their sins. Referred to here as Elohim, he will forgive, he will execute final judgment against Satan and his angels. In the Midrashic style of many of the Qumran writings, this document interprets the Messiah of Isaiah 52, verse 7, and Daniel 9, verse 25, as references to the figure of Melchizedek. In strictly mythopoeic terms, Melchizedek, exalted above the heavenly court as Elohim, appears as a heavenly messianic figure in much the same way as Michael is represented in the Qumran war scroll. In the war scroll, Michael is the Prince of Light, the angel whom God sent to help the sons of light in their final battle. He fights Belial, or Satan, directly, as does Melchizedek in 2QM. Von der Wuda and other scholars feel that these Qumran references could represent early evidences for a Jewish tradition which saw the two separate figures combined into one single identity and role. Whether or not this was the case, what is most important to recognize is that this instance is the appearance of two interesting, rather mysterious characters from Hebrew tradition cast into the role of militant Redeemer and Messiah. It is clear from this, as well as other Qumran manuscripts, that the Covenanters regularly refer to themselves as the Sons of Light and the Holy Ones of God, to name a few. As Vermes says, in a very real sense, the theme of Melchizedek as Redeemer Messiah of the elect Qumran Covenanters sheds valuable light not only on Melchizedek, the Melchizedek figure of the Epistle to the Hebrews, chapter 7, but also on the development of the Messianic concept in the New Testament and early Christianity. This point will be considered in more detail later in this paper. What is particularly important to note here, however, is that at some point in the late intertestamental period, perhaps originally among the Qumran covenanters themselves, the figure of Melchizedek acquired a distinctly eschatological dimension which would remain an integral feature of the literature and tradition concerning him for centuries to come. A precedent of sorts was set, and much more fantastic tradition would be formed around the figure of Melchizedek in rabbinic and Christian circles. An interesting example of the tendency to creatively augment the Melchizedek legend can be seen in the pseudepigraphic Slavonic Second Enoch, or Secrets of Enoch. Unfortunately, very little has been written concerning this rather difficult document, the text of which is only available in late Slavic manuscripts. The most up-to-date comprehensive translations of the Slavic texts is found in Charles Worth's The Old Testament Pseudepigrapha. Among other things, because of the contaminated form of the extant manuscripts of this document and the fact that so few of them have been published for scholarly perusal, no clear decision has been reached concerning the date, provenance, and exact nature of the document. The most objective assessment of the situation seems to be that of F.I. Anderson. Quote, in every respect, Second Enoch remains an enigma. So long as the date and location remains unknown, no use can be made of it for historical purposes. The present writer is inclined to place the book, or at least its original nucleus, early rather than late, and in a Jewish rather than a Christian community. But by the very marginal, if not deviant, character of their beliefs, its users could have been Gentile converts to moral monotheism based on the belief in the antediluvian God of the Bible as creator, but not the God of Abraham or Moses. Although for these reasons, only limited use of this composition by scholars should be presently entertained, perhaps brief mention of its conception of Melchizedek would be appropriate in this instance, since it provides a rather unique account of Melchizedek's origins and purpose, as seen through the eyes of an extremely imaginative apocalypticist. According to the text, Sothonim, the wife of Nir and the sister of Noah, gave birth to a child in her old age on the day of her death. She conceived, but Nir the priest had not slept with her. In addition, she was barren. near, filled with shame, desired to cast her out, but she dies at his feet. Melchizedek is born from Sothonim's corpse. Near and Sothonim, Sothonim's brother, Noah, and then recognize in the child an individual who would eventually become a priest and king in the place Achuzan, that is to say, in the center of the earth where Adam was created. They hide him, fearing that the people would put him to death. The Lord commands Michael, or Gabriel in another ascension, to take the child and place him in the paradise of Edom, so that he may return twice after the flood as a king and arch or high priest for the race of priests yet to come. Both Danielu and Evayon feel that this story is so closely related to the New Testament account of the virgin birth that it probably reflects Christian influence, if not Christian authorship. Anderson argues against this, and rightly so. First of all, Jesus was born of a virgin, but Melchizedek of a barren woman, just as was John the Baptist or Isaac from Sarah. According to Anderson, no Christian could have developed such a blasphemy, and we can imagine a scribe refusing to copy this part. And why should a Jew answer the Christians in this way when the more obvious and more scurrilous explanation of Mary's pregnancy was at hand? Actually, the story seems to reflect the tale of Noah's birth as recounted in the Genesis Apocryphon, in which the wife of Noah is accused of conceiving without her husband. Lamech's wife attempts to convince her husband that Noah was indeed from his seed, but the theme concerning a surprise pregnancy of a barren woman in old age is still present. Although the story does not really coincide with the narrative of the 2QM Qumran document in any clear fashion, what is surprisingly similar between the two is the theme of eschatological appearance of Melchizedek in the cosmos. In both documents, Melchizedek is represented as a heavenly figure with a special mission. What suggests a Jewish origin for at least the core of the second Enoch Melchizedek story, is the obvious attempt to provide this illustrious Old Testament figure with a clear lineage which would appear acceptable to a people and culture obsessed with reputable genealogical provenance for its priests and kings. This tendency to place Melchizedek in some genealogical scheme was often carried to absurd extremes by late Targumic and rabbinical authors who attempted to identify him with Shem. With the exception of Targum Onkelos, Melchizedek is identified with Shem, son of Noah, in both the fragmentary Targum and Pseudo-Jonathan, thereby providing him with an illustrious genealogical tradition. I quote from the fragmentary Targum, quote, "And Melchizedek, king of Jerusalem, who is Shem the Great, was priest of the Most High. He brought forth food and wine, and he was standing and ministering among the great priests before God Most High." End of quote. And from Pseudo-Jonathan, "And Melchizedek, who is Shem, the son of Noah, went out to meet Abraham." End of quote. Many rabbis continue to identify Melchizedek with Shem, often promulgating the idea that he would play some eschatological role in the future. In making this identification, a few rabbis nevertheless attempted to bring Melchizedek into disrepute. I quote, for example, from a passage cited in The Legends of the Jews by Louis Ginsberg, quote, "In the beginning, God wanted to make priests descend from Shem, that is to say, Melchizedek, except that he, Melchizedek, behaved irreverently, in that in his benedictions he mentioned Abraham before mentioning God. And because he noticed this mistake, God made his priesthood pass from Melchizedek to Abraham." End of quote. Although it is rather difficult to date much of the Mishnaic or Talmudic rabbinic literature, most scholars feel that a great deal of it probably was composed anywhere from the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD through the Middle Ages. As with 2nd Enoch, deficient dating and exact historical context for most of these references make them rather unsuitable for historical research. They certainly cannot be utilized by modern scholarship to better understand the biblical Melchizedek tradition, since at best they represent creative invention on the part of rabbis with extraordinary imaginations. As well, the rabbinic sources do not appear to have influenced the portrait of Melchizedek rehearsed in the Hebrews or the Coptic literature which deals with the same figure. On the other hand, both Hebrews and the Coptic Nag Hammadi document entitled Melchizedek display rather surprising ideological affinities, both with each other and at least in one important instance with the Qumran 2QM document. It's possible that Christian and Jewish Melchizedek materials reflect a common tradition. In fact, the concept of Melchizedek found in 2QM may indeed have provided a typological precedent for that found in Hebrews. As mentioned earlier in his paper, the original purpose for the inclusion of the Canaanite Melchizedek Abraham story in the Genesis narrative was primarily for political reasons. The author wished to legitimize the claims of the Davidic monarchy, claims which included the concept that David's rule represented the beginning of a royal dynasty whose power and authority were to continue forever. People shows obeisance to the priest-king Melchizedek, who represents David and his monarchy. By means of this story, the writer of Genesis, who was probably a member of David's court, demonstrated to the Hebrew people through historical precedent the need for them to show obeisance and allegiance to David and his authority. The king that Melchizedek represented, the idea that Melchizedek represented the predecessor of David as the priest-king of Israel, appears to have continued in the consciousness of both Jews for some and some Christians throughout the Middle Ages. It's not surprising, therefore, that those Jews who expected an eschatological Messiah Redeemer would either descend from David in some sort of genealogical succession or at least belong in some way to his authoritative dynastic line. It's not surprising that this group would view his great prototype or predecessor Melchizedek as a likely candidate. After all, it's obvious that the Qumran covenanters at least had grown weary waiting for a local Messiah who would completely liberate them from foreign rule. Neither the Maccabees nor any of the Hasmonean family who enjoyed brief quasi-control of Israel just prior to Pompey's Roman takeover in 63 BC proved to be adequate or worthy of any messianic title. The messianic views of the covenanters were rather complicated and by all means eclectic. The Qumran texts abound with references to at least three types of eschatological Messiah, the first being a prophet recalling Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 18. The second, as already mentioned, sees the Messiah as a royal successor to David. But the most important figure at Qumran was the eschatological anointed priest, the militant Messiah whose battles would be fought against otherworldly evil forces. The covenanter appears to have entertained all three messianic views simultaneously in their eschatological consciousness and may have pictured their ultimate Messiah as a culmination of all the Jewish messianic expectations of the past. This eclectic messianic consciousness appears quite conspicuously in New Testament reference, of course, to Jesus. It is clear that Jesus, the high priest Messiah of the book of Hebrews, echoes the original intention of the writer of the Genesis narrative, and at the same time, practically dates the Qumran view of 2QM document. In the words of Frank Cross, quote, here Jesus is the combined priestly and royal anointed in the type of Melchizedek, the priest-king of Salem in the days of Abraham. One suspects a conscious attempt of the early church to see in its single messianic figure the fulfillment of all the messianic longings of the past, end of quote. In a January 1843 sermon reported by Wilford Woodruff, Joseph Smith was purported to have remarked, quote, Christ was greater than John because he held the keys of the Melchizedek priesthood, end quote. In the book of Hebrews, Jesus would have been considered by the author to have been a high priest while still living, since he says concerning Christ, quote, we have such a high priest in heaven. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be priest at all, end quote. As well, Jesus represented the sole heir to the order of or authority of Melchizedek. This makes clear sense in a first century Christian context, since in the contemporary tradition there could have been only one representative authority which Melchizedek symbolized, namely the long-awaited messianic priest-king. In reference to the ancient authority of Melchizedek, Joseph Smith was simply mistaken when he insisted that, quote, those holding the fullness of the Melchizedek priesthood are kings and priests of the Most High God, holding the keys of power and blessings. Melchizedek ordained Abraham and sent him away. Abraham rejoiced, saying, now I have a priesthood, end of quote. There is no Melchizedek priesthood held by worthy ordained members of the church, spoken of here in Hebrews, or elsewhere in ancient literature for that matter. The order of Melchizedek referred to in Psalms 110 envisioned the authority of the hoped-for eschatological priest-king Messiah only. Hebrews 7 and 15 elaborates this theme, ascribing such eschatological authority to the heavenly Jesus alone. There is no earthly Melchizedek authority mentioned at all. What the author of the Hebrews was attempting to demonstrate in this matter is rather clear, namely, a more comprehensive legitimization of the concept of Jesus as a eschatological priest, king, Messiah, by referring to him as the embodiment, as it were, of the earlier both biblical and perhaps indirectly Qumranian messianic typology represented by the figure of Melchizedek. What better way to emphasize the messianic belief concerning Jesus than to identify him with Melchizedek, who in the local Jewish tradition had always represented an important typological symbol for the Israelite priest-king dynastic ideal. This identification of Jesus with Melchizedek was taken to rather curious extremes by at least one or two Christian Gnostic traditions in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. One of these traditions produced the content of the only tractate in the Coptic Nag Hammadi corpus to mention Melchizedek, that is Codex 9, Tractate 1, entitled Melchizedek. In his excellent study of Codex 9, included as Volume 15 of the Nag Hammadi Study Series, Birger Pearson somewhat tentatively concludes that this document was written somewhere in Egypt in the late 2nd or early 3rd century by Melchizedekian sect, very much like a group described by Epiphanius in his book Heresies 55. In postulating the possible provenance of this document, however, one must proceed with great caution in any attempt to coordinate the Nag Hammadi documents with the polemic statements of church fathers. In this particular case, the description of the Melchizedekians provided by Epiphanius does truly parallel what can be perceived concerning the doctrine held by the writer of Melchizedek. Pearson also feels that the text should be defined as a Gnosticized Jewish-Christian apocalypse. This is quite true, for in many ways its contents closely resemble the apocalyptic nature of Hebrews 7 and the Qumran 2QM document. Unfortunately, the text of Nag Hammadi Melchizedek is extremely fragmentary in places. Only about 40% of the text has been recovered. 47% of the text has been recovered, and some of that by scholarly conjecture. However, what can be understood from the scrutiny of critical scholarship proves to be quite interesting. A crucial passage of the text appears to equate Melchizedek with Jesus. Melchizedek, in a sense, functions on earth as the image or even alter ego, tzuduki, of the heavenly Christ. Page 15, lines 4 to 13 of the text is as follows, quote, "When he came, he raised me up from ignorance and from the fructification of death to life. For I have a name. I am Melchizedek, the priest of God Most High. I know that it is I who am truly the image, or icon, of the true high priest of God Most High." End of quote. A large portion of the tractate relates an eschatological vision presented to Melchizedek, in which he appears to regard himself in the redemptive role of Jesus Christ. On page 25 of the document, Jesus is portrayed as speaking to his heavenly opponents, referring to his death and resurrection. On page 26, Melchizedek is greeted by the heavenly hosts and congratulated for his victory over his enemies. According to Pearson, therefore, our tractate represents to us two Melchizedeks, an ancient priest from biblical history, the ostensible recipient of the revelations and an eschatological redeemer figure, one who is not only made like the Son of God, but who is actually assimilated to Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The idea that Melchizedek, or other ancient personae, for that matter, could revisit the cosmos more than once following their departure from this world is not without precedent in Jewish literature. As has already been mentioned, the Melchizedek figure of 2nd Enoch is presented in three earthly manifestations, before and after the flood, and in the future eschaton. In 1st Enoch, Enoch receives a vision in which he himself would return in the future as the Son of Man in the role of the Redeemer. In this context, it should be noted that at least one early Christian sect was known to have specifically identified Melchizedek with Jesus. Thomas of Marge spoke of an early Christian heresy called the Melchizedekians, who broke out at Skeet in the land of Egypt through the contemptible monks who said that Melchizedek was the Son of God, end of quote. The Melchizedek Codex also contains the concept of Melchizedek as eschatological high priest, which of course calls to mind the identical concept found in the 2QM document from Qumran. As previously noted, it is Christ himself who appears in Hebrews as the heavenly high priest. The Gnostic Melchizedek document appears to have combined the two concepts into one, since, as we have already seen, the document perceived Jesus and Melchizedek as only different manifestations of the same eschatological entity. The unusual concept of twin figures depicting the connection between one's earthly and heavenly counterparts is widespread in the Gnostic literature, the twin pair usually being termed a tzuduki. This Gnostic document is therefore most certainly a syncretic one derived from its primary concepts from both Christian and Jewish materials. As was stated at the beginning of this paper, The purpose of this journey through the Jewish and Christian Melchizedek tradition was nothing more than an attempt to localize certain thematic points in the course of the development of the Melchizedek materials, and to demonstrate the probable significance of these materials relative to the context in which they found their origin and subsequent development. It is clear to this writer, at least, that the only purpose evident from the ancient texts themselves for the inclusion of the Melchizedek figure, together with its often accompanying Mishnaic developments, was always to present some sort of theme of legitimization relative to the authority of any eschatological figure to act as priest's king, whether heavenly or earthly, for literal or symbolic Israel. In other words, the figure of the Melchizedek archpriest always represented in some sense the prototype for each of the very few individuals, whether historical or mythical, who would be termed as an heir to the dynastic authority to rule over Israelite people. There is no mention in any of the ancient texts of any Melchizedek priesthood or authority possessed by anyone except legitimate heirs to the theocratic rule of Israel. This included Christians who clearly perceived themselves as Israelites, if only symbolically in certain instances, and who worshipped their legitimate priest king, Jesus, whose kingdom was not of this world. This paper is not suggesting that Mormonism's claim to a present-day order of Melchizedek are unfounded or false per se, but simply that they should not be founded on ancient precedents which simply do not appear to have existed. Melchizedek was a fascinating figure throughout the history of both Jewish and Christian textual tradition, and much more work remains to be accomplished toward a greater understanding of the significance of such a figure in the history and development of both Jewish and Christian messianism. Thank you.